This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
We were shocked to see the recent cover story on Time Magazine, the photograph of an Afghan woman, her nose and ears allegedly cut off by members of the Taliban forces in Afghanistan. My guests are Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Their most recent book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. They join me on the program. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon to you. Glad to be back.
Yeah, we're both here.
Absolutely. Welcome to the program. So let me start with you, Liz. What was your reaction when you saw that photograph on the cover of Time magazine?
Well, you know, it really just brought me back. You know, when you go back even just to 2001 in terms of the women's issue, anyone who's really been following it knows that when a magazine like Time magazine basically is promoting the idea that the United States really can't alter its military situation simply because of the women's issue, we know that something is wrong. Because when you go back to 2001, after the Taliban was driven out of Afghanistan, the Bush administration basically did everything in its power to guarantee that the women's issue was actually going to collapse. So this is really a great concern, you know, in 2010, to see the issue being dredged up again, because Bush actually claimed that was one of the reasons he was going into Afghanistan, was to actually try to save the Afghan women from the brutality of the Taliban, which was a genuine motivating force during the last half of the 90s. There was a tremendous movement by women and many organizations around the world trying to bring attention to the plight of Afghan women. So this is really just another example of how, when you don't have the long, complex understanding of how these things can be utilized over time, you lose track of it. And then people respond emotionally to the appeal.
We're talking with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. The book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. And it's one of the things that you both bring to this conversation is that long backstory to the troubled story of what's happening in Afghanistan today and how America got wrapped up in this thing, and you know, Americans are dying now every day in Afghanistan. Paul, we're seeing women being used then to serve the political interests and of warlords on both sides of this issue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been going on, as Liz said, for, you know, a number of years, and you know, you have to wonder what the real agenda is. You know, it's kind of been, women have been used as an issue. It was the feminist majority, actually, back in the late 1990s, that actually brought attention to the plight of Afghan women. And of course, I'm sure you recall the whole issue about the burqa, the so-called burqa. Actually, what's interesting about this is that the burqa is a Pakistani term for the head-to-toe covering. Chadori is the name that the Afghans use to describe it, and the chador is the shorter veil. And you know, once again, what we seem to be getting again and again, we have a detente position. We keep looking at this perspective on Afghanistan back from a Pakistani point of view, which of course is a result of the British Empire's influence on American thinking from 1947 on. And so we've never really broken out of that kind of trap. We've never really gone back and looked at the entire situation from the ground up and said, you know, the situation with Afghanistan and Pakistan really has a lot to do with Pakistan, its fear for its survival as a nation against India, and the belief by Pakistani elites, mostly in the military, that it needs to control Afghanistan in order to have a safe haven for its forces in case of a war with India. So, you know, the woman's issue has been one of the main things that has been played upon by many administrations, and the fundamental issue is this, regarding the Karzai administration and its relationship to Afghan women, is the Karzai administration is an Islamist administration. The United States government has backed Islamists since the 1970s, since the 1978 Marxist coup, certainly, but even before that, since 1973. in order to control that part of the world. They've worked through Pakistan, they've worked with Saudi Arabia, they've worked with other forces in the Middle East, and those things are still very much at play here. We don't hear about it, but they're very much influencing decisions in Washington and in Afghanistan.
We're honored to be talking with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. The book is Invisible History, two of the best investigative reporters covering the war in Afghanistan. So, Liz, if I hear y'all right, the U.S.-backed Karzai administration is no more friendlier to the plight of women in Afghanistan than perhaps the Taliban would be if they were in charge.
Absolutely. In fact, I'd like to read a quote from you from an Ann Jones article in The Nation just this week. And she says, "Our government complains that the Karzai administration is corrupt, but the greater problem never mentioned is that it is fundamentalist. The cabinet, courts, and parliament are largely controlled by men who differ from the Taliban chiefly in their choice of turbans." That's the end of the quote. Now, I do want to basically, once again, though, go back to the Bonn conference that followed the removal of the Taliban in 2001 from Afghanistan to start the new government for Afghanistan. The Karzai was handpicked by the Bush administration, was pretty much forced on the Afghan people at that point. In fact, the Afghans actually had a Loya Jirga in 2002 and had preferred to bring back the king. There were other individuals besides Karzai. These were all rejected by the Bush administration. So once again, when you look at an administration that basically has already shown that he is very much supporting the kind of practices that would be much more similar to the Taliban itself, maybe not as severe. That's why we refer to him more as a moderate Islamist rather than extremist Islamist. But these are still alien to the way in which Kabul operated preceding the Soviet invasion. In fact, even during the Soviet era, this is something from Red Kabul Revisited. Jonathan Steele was the Guardian reporter who actually was the Moscow reporter who was in Kabul at that time. This would have been in 1981. It says, "Kabul's two campuses thronged with women students as well as men. Most went around without even a headscarf. Hundreds of universities were studying engineering, medicine. The banquet halls of the Kabul Hotel pulsed with music every night for wedding parties." This was during the Soviet occupation. He actually goes on to say the Russians did nothing to stop this vibrant private enterprise. So, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what actually happened during the actual, during the 70s before the invasion, and then during the occupation, and then what happened in the 90s when the Mujahideen that had been financed by the U.S. had literally started a civil war between each other and destroyed most of Kabul at that point. That was actually in the early 1990s to 96. So what we're looking at is a lot of misunderstanding about what Afghanistan was, what Kabul was, what women's rights were. And now we're looking at Karzai, who does not represent, in terms of historical perspective, a typical Afghan leader at all.
So if I hear you right, Paul, it's the Western-backed, Western-supported, whether it's America or Britain, it's the Western-supported Islamic fundamentalist forces in Afghanistan that are the real threat to women. And if you go back before our involvement, there was actually a moderating, more Western-like movement that benefited women in Afghanistan before we got there.
There's no question about that. In the United States, during the 1960s, from 1963 to 1973, the United States supported what was referred to as the experiment in democracy. That was the time period when King Zahir Shah was actively ruling the country. Things did not go well, and they didn't go well for a lot of reasons, but mainly because of the economy. The Afghan economy had been starved since the 1840s when the British came in. The area of what is now South Punjab, the frontier provinces on the other side of the border, what are now Pakistan, that used to be part of Afghanistan. There was access to the sea through Baluchistan. So that when Britain went in there, they marched up to the edge of the Hindu Kush, drew a line down the middle of it, and said, this is the Durand Line. We're going to govern everything on this side, and we're going to fence you off on the other side. And that's what that was economically devastating to Afghanistan. But there was a progressive streak, nonetheless, inside Afghan politics and Afghan royal family and the Afghan ruling class and elites that was very, very progressive, and it was known to be progressive. And there's lots of material out there about that. And even there's a professor out at Williams College, Dave Edwards, who knows Afghanistan very well. He used to be, I believe, with the National Geographic magazine. And he wrote a book years ago and stated the fact that the coming of the progressives and the Marxists in the 1970s, he says, was really an evolution. It really wasn't the Russians that were responsible for infiltrating communism into Afghanistan. There was a progressive streak in the Afghans that went back to the 16th century, and that was simply what they were just another incarnation of that. And that's still there. And that's what the United States is missing out on, and that's what really is a shame about this whole situation. Moderates have really not been fostered, certainly not during the 1980s and the 1990s. The moderates were left to fend for themselves. In Pakistan, they were exiled. The Taliban were supported. The extremists were supported. In fact, in many cases, there are actual reports where the British High Commissioner was supposedly reported to have been helping to recruit Taliban in order to help wipe out some of these evil warlords back in the mid-1990s. So, you know, you have an active participation by government officials to promote an extremist group. You know, we've had since the 1990s in the Clinton administration this effort to try to, you know, to peel so-called moderate Taliban away from the extremist Al-Qaeda influences. You know, and from our perspective, this is just public relations.
We're talking with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Their most recent book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Liz, can you take a moment and extend that, what Paul is saying, extend this a little bit with a little bit historical perspective and clarify a point that that we've talked about before on this program, and that is the direct Western involvement in fostering and abetting the creation and the health of dangerous Islamic fundamentalists. And I'm not going to try to – I'm not arguing that militant Islamic fundamentalism didn't exist before the West got involved. But when the West got involved, it certainly grew. Could you explain that?
Well, actually, once again, we have to go back to the British Empire. The British Empire really preferred to motivate the reactionary mullahs and the reactionary elements within Afghanistan. In fact, when King Amanullah in the 1920s put forth the first constitution, which gave women the right to vote and included many of what I think today would be considered incredibly advanced thinking about fundamental human rights and dignity for all of the various ethnic groups within Afghanistan, what ended up happening was that the British ended up in fact, I think it was Lawrence of Arabia was believed to have been recruited to basically go in and infiltrate and to stir up and cause problems for the king's attempt to modernize the country. And that historians now looking back at the evidence of what happened have come to the conclusion that the failure of Amanullah's effort to modernize was not a revulsion of modernization by the Afghan people, but rather it had more to do with, once again, the economic difficulties to support the modernization with an economic reality, and it was also the fact that the British were undermining Amanullah directly. So here you had a very progressive leader that was intentionally undermined. Well, again, when you look at Afghan history, and again, as I pointed out about the fact that the king, who was considered to be a progressive, who was trying to advance and modernize Afghanistan in the 1970s, he was the desired choice of the Afghan people to come back. So once again, this kind of progressive leader was clearly the first choice of the Afghan people in 2001.
But Western forces wouldn't stand for it.
Well, that's exactly what I referred to before, but the Bush administration intentionally rejected the king being brought back as a symbolic and an influence on reuniting the country.
Well, he was a strong influence in terms of Afghan nationalism. And, of course, the Pakistanis, if anything, do not want a strong Afghan nation. They want a weak Afghan nation. And they've made that recently quite clear. Over the last 6 months, the Pakistanis have come forward. General Kayani and a number of Pakistani ISI people have come forward and told the Americans point blank, we want complete influence over any Afghan government that you have in there. And if we don't get it, we're going to continue to support the insurgents. Now, the WikiLeaks documents, of course, are full of indications of how they're still doing that, and they continue to do that. Lieutenant General Hamid Ghul, as an example, has been cited in these documents as having supported these people directly. And also, too, Zardari, the president of Pakistan, is also said to have met with them, met with people who have been captured. He went to a prison. He talked with the people, and he said, we're really on your side. As soon as the Americans wanted us to roust you and put you in jail because we had to show them results. But as soon as the Americans go, we'll let you out. So I mean, this is really kind of the cat and mouse game that's been going on for many. The entire relationship, basically, of the U.S. with Pakistan has been a kind of cat and mouse game. And even when we were doing our book, if you look into the basic documents back to the 1960s and the 1970s, you've got American case officers in Afghanistan and Pakistan saying, you know, look at. The Pakistanis will use any excuse whatsoever to claim that the Soviets are going to invade Pakistan if we don't give them, if the United States doesn't give them the jets and the helicopters and the armaments and the money that they need specifically to that they believe that they needed to defend themselves. So that's the number one priority, and that's I don't think that's what most Americans understand is that maybe they do now because there's been so much of it going on in the last few years.
Well, let me ask you that. And just, Liz, take a moment to underscore this. We got a couple of minutes left. Take a moment to underscore the real significance of some of the items there in the WikiLeaks documents that have come forward.
Well, the WikiLeaks documents, one of the things that came forward in them was the fact that the women's issue was going to be used as an attempt to try to influence people to support the military, advancing militarily. And this is clearly one of the reasons, as you asked originally, what my opinion was when I saw the cover of Time magazine. Knowing that really just, that just sealed the deal. You know, what I already understood about the way in which the women's issue was used was in apparently black and white in WikiLeaks, that in fact that's what it's there for.
It's propaganda.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question. There is a legitimate and a very serious issue regarding what would happen if the West withdrew forces and left the women to themselves. That's clearly an issue. But the problem is that it has not been dealt with correctly. We have not been told the truth about what's going on. We've not been told the truth about the people that we're supporting there. The fact is that we've been given a choice here in the United States to either support warlords or to support the Taliban, so-called moderate elements of the Taliban, which is, of course, not really the issue at all. There are all kinds of other people who are being excluded from this process.
And certainly the most progressive Western-like Afghans are being excluded from control by the West.
And that actually has been going on since the United States got involved in the late 1970s, early 1980s. The moderates were always excluded. In fact, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was considered dangerous by many Afghans working with the United States. He ended up receiving the bulk of the U.S. funding going through Pakistan, even though many Afghans requested Charlie Wilson not allow that money to get into the hands of Gulbuddin. He was considered dangerous for the Afghan people.
And again, before we let you go, why is it then? That's the question Americans will be asking. Why is it that we aren't supporting the most progressive Western-like forces in Afghanistan, but we're supporting Taliban-like, basically?
Well, I think we really have to realize that this really has more to do with geostrategy. It has to do with control of Eurasia. The only reason that you would want to have a weakened Afghanistan and a dysfunctional state in Afghanistan that would be ruled effectively by warlords and or Taliban-like creatures would be in order to make sure that the national interests of the country would be completely undermined. There would be no nation, really, anymore. It would more function like a Saudi Arabia, which would become a, could become a client state of the United States.
Elizabeth, so, yeah, go ahead, Paul, real quick.
Yeah, you also have this whole idea about the whole internationalism of the issue. For the Western nations, I mean, you know, back in the 1980s, it was the United States against international communism. Well, now it's against international Islam. But the fact is that there are strong relations, business relations, between the United States, the oil companies, and the Saudi Arabian oil companies, and both interests. And it's no coincidence that, you know, so much of our American government and the people who are involved in this issue, you know, are represent the kind of Texas oil business influence. And there's no question about that. When we were involved in this back in the even in the late 1990s, a lot of the people who were very much pushing the Taliban coming into power were oil interests in South Texas. Who really didn't care about the fact that, you know, that what these guys' philosophy was. It was the fact is that they were willing to pacify the countryside by any means possible so that the oil interests could get their pipelines across Afghanistan and get those oil-rich regions in South Central Asia piping gas and oil into India and Pakistan.
Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, the book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Always great to talk to you both. Thanks.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.